Please be seated. You may have heard it said that the preachers have two jobs, to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And today I desperately hope to do both. Today I intend to resurrect Robin Hood, the Prince of Thieves, or for our purposes today, the Prince of moral ambiguity. Is Robin Hood the best example we have of a folk hero, a man who undertook great personal risk to provide for the very poor? Or is Robin Hood simply a thief whose story has been spun by the very best PR people through the ages? Today, I invite you to journey into moral ambiguity with me, to walk through the no woman's land between what we should do and what we are compelled to do as human beings and especially as followers of Jesus. Today, I ask you to consider what we mean when we speak of having a moral compass, core values, convictions, and principles. We speak of these things with certainty, as if they're immutable, as if they're permanent and inescapable, like our DNA or our fingerprints. But how is our moral compass oriented? On what do we base our core values and our convictions? Why do we claim to have principles and not simply preferences? To begin with, I'd like each of us to take a quick read of our own moral compass. Imagine that you are in a situation in which you can only rescue one of each of the following pairs, only one. Which do you save? Now, don't overthink these, okay? Go with your first instinct. Number one, which do you save, a stranger or your dog? Number two, a dog or a possum? Number three, a bottle with the cure for cancer or your brother? Number four, a bottle with the cure for cancer or your brother who just donated you one of his kidneys? Now, clearly, those are not the type of moral choices we're likely to be faced with every living day of our lives. But we often do find ourselves in situations that call for us to make difficult moral or ethical decisions. Fortunately for us, as people of faith, when it comes to these issues, we have an operating manual, a moral volume that many claim tells us exactly what we should do by telling us exactly what Jesus would do. So today, we're going to take a look at that manual, at the Bible. And not just the Bible, but to the Jesus narrative as it was told by Luke. We're going to look at that story for an example of how we can find true north for our own moral compass. Now, you've just heard Tom read the first 8 verses of chapter 16 of Luke. Let me summarize that for you very quickly, and I want you to listen carefully, because when I'm finished, I'm going to ask you to supply Jesus's words from verse 9 of the 16th chapter. All right. Jesus told his disciples that charges of fraud were brought against a rich man's manager. The manager knew he was going to be fired, so he contacted all those who owed money to the rich man and dramatically cut what they owed the rich man. When the rich man heard what the manager was doing, he commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. And the rich man said, "The children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light." Okay, that's verse 8. In verse 9, we hear Jesus and what he has to say about it. And we're going to take a little quiz called, "What Would Jesus Do Now?" Or really, "What Would Jesus Say?" And I'm going to give you the opportunity to predict and vote on what you think Jesus set. Okay? So here are your four choices. A, and Jesus said, but I tell you that this manager has been deceitful like the serpent in praising the manager for dishonesty. Now that sounds reasonable, doesn't it? How often did Jesus warn us not to be a stumbling block to others? B, then Jesus said, but I tell you, the rich man should rather praise the manager for distributing the rich man's wealth to the poor, for accumulation of wealth destroys the soul. Now that fits right in line with it being easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to get into heaven, doesn't it? C, how about this one? And Jesus said, but I tell you that every one of these, the rich man, the manager, and the debtors, have all alike sinned, for they have all practiced deceit against their brothers and their sisters. You might be tempted to choose this one, knowing that Jesus was always concerned with how we treat each other and encouraged us to treat others as we would like to be treated. And then D, this is a throwaway answer, but I really wanted to have four. So, and I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into their eternal homes. All right, now I'm going to give you a chance. Please raise your hand if you vote for A, the manager has also been deceitful. Did Jesus say the manager has also been deceitful? Okay, B, Jesus said that the accumulation of wealth destroys the soul. Okay, and C, Jesus said the rich man and the manager sinned because they practiced deceit. Okay. And just in case any of you did want to vote for D. Yeah. And so if you've really been following, you know what I'm about to say. The correct answer is clearly D. D. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into their eternal homes. That, friends, is the way that Jesus weighs in. Now, I've got to tell you a little backstory about this sermon today. I last preached on this scripture, the one and only time, 11 years ago. And on that Sunday night, I had to make an unplanned trip to Belton because our oldest daughter, who was going to UMHB, had left her backpack with all her books and all her notes and everything she needed for college on the kitchen table. So I was driving on Sunday evening an hour and 20 minutes to Belton to deliver her backpack, and I wanted to use the time well. So I knew I was going to be preaching on this passage the next day, but I didn't have a copy of it with me, and so I called home, and I asked my beloved Stacy if she would go get a Bible and read me the first 9 verses of chapter 16 of Luke. So she did, and she starts to read, and she gets to verse 9, and she says, well, wait a minute. I'm going to go get a different translation. And she goes, and she finds another translation. She comes back, and she says, well, this can't be right. I've never heard this. This is crazy. Jesus wouldn't say this. And I was like, yeah, I knew that's what it said. But I don't know what I'm going to do with that. 11 years later, and I'm not much further along with this particular story. But friends, here's a simple truth. Though I think it's wonderful to think about what Jesus would say and pray about what Jesus would do, the bottom line is that we rarely, if ever, can tell with certainty what Jesus would do. And it can be very dangerous to think we know what Jesus would do. One of my favorite stories about knowing what Jesus would do happened in the late 1960s. The issue of segregation divided the nation and congregations and families, and Roy Campbell Jr. was an elder in Greenville, Mississippi's First Presbyterian Church. And he found himself in opposition to his mother on this issue of desegregating the congregation. He felt that African Americans should be welcomed into this white church, and his mother did not. Finally, tired of arguing with her, he asked in exasperation, "Mother, what do you think Jesus would do if he were standing at the front door of First Presbyterian Church on a Sunday morning?" And she said, without hesitation, "I know exactly what he would do." And he would be wrong. Sometimes we have to laugh to keep from crying. What would Jesus do in real messy human life? How can we really hope to know what Jesus would do? Now, please hear me. I'm not saying we shouldn't consider what Jesus would do or that it's not important what Jesus would do. I'm just admitting that, as this parable makes completely, painfully clear, it's hard to know sometimes. Today, I encourage you to find peace with not knowing. Richard Rohr recently wrote, "It's difficult to grow spiritually without a strong tolerance for ambiguity, an ability to allow, forgive, and contain a certain degree of anxiety, and a willingness not to know, and not even to need to know." I shared these words recently with our discernment team, reminding them that as we continue to work on identifying and strengthening the core values and mission of MCC Austin, that we must do so with a spirit of inquiry, always open, always checking our motivations. And that's something that all of us should be committed to during this season of discernment. But if we're trying to find peace with that, then what do we do when ambiguity really troubles us? Some of us want to know what to do. Some of us desperately want to know what Jesus would do, so that we can try to do that as well. Well, for those of you, I offer this morning some hopeful words, beginning with these: God is faithful, and if you seek, you will find. So how do you go about searching for the answer to what would Jesus do? Let me offer some suggestions. First, be willing to admit that you don't know. Stay curious, Maggie Dugan says. Seek to understand the things that would otherwise induce a judgment. Avoid assumptions and try to take an open-minded, curious stance about what's happening around you. Ask questions, Dugan says, that start with why, and say things like, "Tell me more about that." When we determine too quickly that we've come to the right answer or the best solution, we often stop right there. That's exactly what we should continue to ask ourselves. Why? What next? How? The spirit of inquiry, so that we don't stop too soon. Several years ago, the National Parks Service was wrestling with quite a problem. The stone exterior of the Lincoln Memorial was deteriorating and showing significant signs of wear. They considered replacing all the stone or painting over it on a frequent basis, but that solution was way too expensive. So instead, they called in the maintenance crew and they asked them, "Why is the stone deteriorating? And the maintenance crew said, because of the high power sprayers we use to wash it every 2 weeks. Now, the executives could have solved the problem right there by stopping and saying, don't wash the monument with high powered sprayers every 2 weeks. But instead, they asked, why are we washing with high-powered sprayers every 2 weeks? And the maintenance crew said, because of the bird droppings. Then it became obvious to them that if they got rid of the birds, they'd get rid of the bird droppings also. So they asked the maintenance crew to set up large nets in strategic places to capture and carry away the birds. It didn't work. So then they thought to ask the maintenance crew, well, why are there so many birds? And the maintenance crew said, the birds come to feed on the spiders. Why are there so many spiders? Have you ever been to the memorial at night? The crew asked. There are billions of insects. The spiders come for the buffet. Armed with this information, the executives ordered regular treatments with insecticides. But this also proved expensive and created even more complaints from the tourists. So finally, they ditched that solution and they asked another question. Why are there so many insects? Because the insects are attracted by the high-powered spotlights we shine on the memorial. Why didn't you tell us that before we ordered all the insecticide treatments? Because you didn't ask. The executives answered their last few questions on their own. Why do we shine the lights? So the tourists will come to see the memorial. Why do we want the tourists? Because they spend lots of money in our city. And then they asked themselves questions. Is there anything we can do about the lights so that there won't be so many bugs? Sure, the maintenance crew said. Just turn the lights on later in the evenings and turn them off earlier in the mornings. The bugs will go somewhere else. And that's exactly what happened. By waiting 30 minutes after sunset to turn off the lights and by turning them on 30 minutes before sunrise, turning them off 30 minutes before sunrise, they figure they eliminated 90% of the insects and the birds. And the bird droppings. Be willing to admit that you don't know, or at least enter in with a spirit of inquiry and allow yourself to know that you aren't certain. Second, pray. Pray without ceasing. And I only put, for those of you who are worried that I put pray second instead of first, I only put pray second to encourage you not to pray for the answers that you have already decided are true. I'm not going to repeat our recent series on prayer, but if you ask, I'll send you the links to those sermons. Pray. Third, read the Bible. But don't read the Bible the way you would scan a textbook to find and verify the answers that you're sure you already know. And please consider reading the whole thing, which will take days and hours and months, which will rightly take a lifetime. But think how we read the Bible sometimes. We're willing to open it up, find a verse, find a chapter, and stake our lives upon it. And sometimes that might be all right, but think about your favorite novel. What is it that makes it your favorite? Is it the themes, the truths, having things brought home to you that you already hold dear? What is it? And think about taking that book and opening it up and taking one sentence or one paragraph and suggesting that in that one you have represented the whole. And yet we use the Bible that way quite often. And if you are worried about your biblical knowledge or lack thereof, consider Sunday morning Bible study. Conversational format. I've been told there's no homework. with people who care about you. 9:30 every Sunday morning. And 4, discuss what you are struggling with in community. Don't go and lock yourself away. You might have come to some wrong conclusions. My band director used to say to us, if every single other person in the band is playing the wrong note, and then he always stopped right there, because I think he made his point. If every other single person is playing the wrong note. So take it to community. And not just a community of like-minded people. When faced with a difficult choice or a difficult situation, I invite you not only to seek out those with whom you agree, but also those with whom you do not, and enter into conversation with them. And here I'm just inserting a pastoral note. Gauge your own strength. Gauge your own readiness. You don't have to put yourself in positions where you know that others are going to be unloving, ungenerous, unkind, unlearned. Don't do that to yourself. But in many situations, it's okay to seek out those with whom you have disagreements and enter into conversation. And please, during our ongoing discernment time, which is scheduled to take us through another 6 months or more, as we continue to ask questions about the way the Spirit may be whispering to us about what is needed in this world that we can provide, stay in conversation with one another. Stay in contact with one another. And within those conversations, run frequent self-checks. Here's one I like to practice. You've heard it said, think before you speak. You may not have heard this little device for what it means to think before you speak. Before you speak, ask, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it inspiring? Is it necessary? Is it kind? Think before you speak. Friends, the whole world seems to be asking at times, what would Jesus do? And I don't know. But I am sure that if we faithfully seek to find that answer, then God, who is love, will bless us and keep close to us and be gracious unto us and find favor with us and grant us peace. Amen.